Hi, and welcome to the Easton Bible Church podcast. We're so excited you've joined us today. Our hope is that God uses this message to help you experience a deeper, life-changing relationship with Jesus, because Jesus changes everything. Enjoy today's message.
All right, now we're continuing our series in some of Jesus' parables, and what we've said throughout the series is that these parables are these short and simple stories, but they're not simplistic. There's something very profound about the stories that Jesus tells, And the reality is that Jesus, he uses these stories because he wants to disrupt our false realities. Have you ever had a favorite mirror? You know, that mirror in your house that you just look really good? You know, I've got several mirrors in our house, but there's one mirror, I'll be honest. You know, and the lighting is just a little bit better maybe, or maybe there's a little extra distortion to that mirror. And I know I don't actually look that good, and I don't have a lot to work with, but in that mirror, I like the way I look a little bit better than all those other mirrors. And you know, you've got that mirror that you can look at and you just feel a little bit better about you. You know, it's that mirror that you know it's not really an accurate reflection, but it might be that last mirror that you want to look at before you walk outside. You could just pretend in your mind's eye that that's how you looked to everybody else. I just wish I could find a mirror that put hair on my head. That would be, you know, that would really be something, right? But see, the disruptive power of Jesus' parables is that they force us, if we have the courage to listen, they force us to take a hard look at the realities of us, of who we are, instead of settling for the safe ease of our imaginary selves. And so the parable that I want to look at this morning is, I think, one of Jesus's most hard-hitting parables. I know what you're thinking. Some of you are like, why did we come? We could have been at the shore, you know, with everybody else. But this is one of those parables that makes us wrestle with one of the hard realities of life. It deals with a facet of human existence that we simply cannot escape. Nor should we. And it sounds simple at one level. In fact, it sounds even easy, but it may be the hardest thing that you will ever do in your life. So in Matthew chapter 18, starting verse 21, Matthew records this moment. And he says this, "Then Peter came to Jesus and asked, 'Lord, how many times shall I forgive my brother when he sins against me? Up to seven times?'" I love Peter because Peter, he says everything that we would say if we didn't have a filter. And see, Peter, he has in the back of his mind, he has what he has been taught all of his life, which is that three times is how many times you should forgive people, because that was standard in the rabbinical teachings. If you looked at traditional Judaism, how many times should you forgive someone? Three. It's sort of like that idea of, if you fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me, fool me three times, I will punch you in the face, right? It's this idea of at some point you have to cut it off, because otherwise they will just take advantage of you. So how many times should you forgive? Well, three times enough, but Peter, he's an overachiever, right? He's trying to impress Jesus. He's like, "Jesus, I know it's three for, you know, mere mortals, but I'm thinking seven. How's that, Jesus? You should be really impressed with seven. Isn't that, it's way more than three." And Jesus answered in verse 22, "I tell you, not seven times, but 77 times." And some translations actually think that maybe he's saying 70 times seven, but it doesn't really matter. I can just imagine Peter, though. He's listening. He says, "Okay, Jesus, I see what you did there. You know, I get it, that's cute. I said seven, and now you're like 77. That's nice." But see, Jesus actually isn't interested in setting a numerical limit to forgiveness. That's not really his point. For him, the number is purely symbolic. He's not setting a number limit as though God is watching over us with a checklist going, okay, 74, 75, almost there, 76, 77, okay, you're good. Now you don't have to forgive anymore. I think Jesus is actually answering a very different question. He's approaching it from a very different perspective. Have you ever forgiven someone and then felt like it didn't stick? You know, you forgave someone, and in that moment, you were sincere. I am choosing to forgive this person, but then something happened. Maybe you see them again. Maybe there's something that just rubs that raw wound one more time, and it feels fresh all over again, and all those emotions and the bitterness and the anger and the resentment become flooding back. See, there's sometimes when the pain that we feel is so deep from that wound that we can't simply forgive one time and it eradicates all of it at once. That sometimes what we have to do is we actually have to forgive the same offense repeatedly, over and over again, until the pain begins to subside. And see, what Jesus is saying here is not, Well, look, you have this obligation to forgive over and over. Every time somebody sins against you and they just keep sinning and you keep forgiving 77 times, no, what he's saying is not what are you obligated to forgive, but how many times do you need to forgive until you're finally free, until your heart can finally heal? Because it may take more than once. And there may be no end. But see, Jesus, he knows Peter. He knows Peter's probably trying to wrap his head around the number. I can see Peter getting his Excel spreadsheet out, and he's got the names and the number of times he's forgiven, and he wants to keep track. And so Jesus, he gives them a parable to bring it home. Verse 23, therefore, Jesus said, the kingdom of heaven is like a king who wanted to settle accounts with his servants. And as he began the settlement, a man who owed him 10,000 servants was brought to him. Now, just to give you an idea of the amount of debt that we're talking about here, King Herod, who, by the way, was not really a king, you know, he just liked to be called king because it's good to be called king if you can get away with it. But see, he was actually a steward. He was a vassal under the Roman Empire. And so he only served at their good pleasure because kings don't answer to anybody, like true kings. But he was kind of a puppet king. But see, King Herod, when he would collect taxes for the entire year, his annual tax was around 200 talents. And this is 10,000 talents. If you were to do the math, there's estimates as high as $1 trillion, especially in today's world of inflation. Right? This is a very, very high number, which is kind of confusing because how would a servant, right? These are servants. How would they ever accrue this kind of debt? See, I can't get $1 million into debt. Like, I don't have that much money, and I don't even have that kind of credit. You see, I can only get in debt up to the amount of money that I have, or at least the credit limit I have, you know, so I can get a few $1,000s in debt, but I can't get $1 million in debt, much less $1 billion, much less $1 trillion in debt. It would never happen. And so how is it that a servant, a mere servant, would be able to get into this kind of debt? But see, for Jesus' audience, they understand that anybody who serves the king, they're all servants. We tend to think of the people, you know, cooking and doing the laundry as the servants to the king, but they're thinking someone more like Herod, someone who's a governor over an entire territory who collects tribute, who collects taxes. And even then, he was only bringing in about 200 talents a year. And this is 10,000, which means there is no way that he could possibly pay it off. This is an obscene amount, and that's the point. You can't pay it back. And so what does he do? Verse 25, since he was not able to pay, the master ordered that he and his wife and his children and all that they had be sold to repay the debt. So in the ancient Near East, the ancient world, it was common for those who were in debt and their families to be sold into slavery. But it wasn't slavery in the way we tend to think of it. It wasn't lifelong slavery. They were sold into slavery in order for them to repay the debt. And once it was paid, they would be freed. In fact, there were oftentimes there were people who would get into debt themselves, and they would willfully, of their own volition, sell themselves into debt or into slavery in order to pay off their debt. This was just how the economy worked. But in this case, they're never going to get out of slavery. This debt is simply too high to ever repay. And the servant fell on his knees before him. Be patient with me, he begged, and I will pay back everything, which is absurd. It's complete nonsense. And he knows it, and the king knows it. He's just saying whatever he thinks will buy him a little bit more time. He's desperate. But get this, the servant's master took pity on him. The word here for pity is a word that's derived from the Greek word spanknon. It's a fun word, isn't it? And it has to do with your intestines, your splanknon. It's like your guts, it's your heart, it's your lungs. And it has this sense of like there's this deep empathy, this deep compassion that you feel in, deep within yourself, and it extends towards the other person. It's like you're opening your heart up to them. It's actually a beautiful picture of empathy. Your heart goes out to them. And so he had pity on him. And he canceled the debt and he let him go. But when that servant went out, he found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 denarii, which was still a lot of money. It was a few $1,000s probably. But it's just nothing compared to what this first servant owed the king. But he grabbed him and began to choke him. Pay back what you owe me, he demanded. And his fellow servant fell to his knees and begged him, be patient with me and I will pay you back, which should sound familiar because it's basically what that first servant said to the king when there was no way he could pay him back. This guy could actually conceivably pay him back, but he wants nothing of it. He says, no. Verse 30, but he refused. Instead, he went off and had the man thrown into prison until he could pay the debt. When the other servants saw what had happened, they were greatly distressed and went and told their master everything that had happened. And the master called the servant in. You wicked servant, he said, I canceled all that debt of yours because you begged me to. Shouldn't you have had mercy on your fellow servant just as I had on you? And in anger, his master turned him over to the jailers to be tortured until he should pay back all he owed. This is how my heavenly Father will treat each of you unless you forgive your brother from your heart. I don't know about you, I don't really like how Jesus ends this parable. This is not the ending that I would have written. Jesus, I wish you could have written a different one. Give us something else. I don't like this part about the king handing the servant over to the jailers to be tortured. That seems excessive to me. And then Jesus actually makes it even worse because he says, this is how my heavenly Father will treat each of you unless you forgive your brother from your heart. Jesus, are you saying that if we don't forgive other people's debts against us, you're not going to forgive ours? And if we don't forgive, then you're going to throw us into hell. You're going to have us tortured. Is that what you're saying? So let me give you the good news. It's nice to have good news in a moment like this, isn't it? Give you a little good news. Jesus isn't saying that God is waiting with torturers to torture you if you don't forgive someone else. He's not saying that. One of the ways that we get into trouble as sort of left-brain people is that we try to read theological propositions into parables, but parables aren't meant to be read as propositional statements. They are theological, but they're analogies. They're meant to be read in such a way that it shows us glimpses and pieces of reality, but not every single part of the parable corresponds to reality. And so no, God is not waiting with torturers, just waiting for you to not forgive someone. Right? Somebody's rude to you at Walmart and you forget to forgive them, and he's not like, okay, get out the thumbscrew. It's time to, you know, electric shock, here we come. That is reading far too much into the parable. But here's the not so good news. What Jesus is saying is that God doesn't need to throw you into prison and he doesn't need to cast you into hell, because if you refuse to forgive someone else, you are already living in a prison of your own making. Have you ever had someone wrong you and then you laid in bed at night and you played it over and over in your head and you replayed the moment and then you imagined what you would say to them if you only had the chance? Things that if only I could just say this word, man, then I would make them pay. They would feel the pain that they've caused me. Or maybe you dream up elaborate schemes of how you're going to slash their tires when no one's looking, right? You know, we have these schemes that we make up and we're so creative about it, and we dream of how we are going to make that other person pay. And in our dreams, man, we do. We beat them up good. We make them feel the pain they've made us feel. Isn't it interesting though, that the next time you see them, they seem okay? It's like that night before, you're dreaming, you've beaten the tar out of them, and then you see them the next day, it's like they don't even know. They had no idea that you have just trashed them in your imagination. See, the reality is, the truth is, that while we savor our revenge, don't we? You know, we dream of revenge, we play those conversations over our head, how we are going to get back at them. And while it tastes so good, feasting on those illusions and dreams of revenge, what we're actually feasting on is ourselves. Because we're the only ones who are paying in those moments. They have no idea it's happening. You're just eating away at your own soul. And yet, for most of us, most of the time, that's as good as it gets, isn't it? We just dream of revenge. We dream of getting back, and then nothing ever happens of it. But can I tell you, even if in those rare moments you are able to get even with them, it will never be enough. It's actually not all that you hoped and dreamed it would be. Have you ever had a moment where somebody hurt you, and then you did get them back, and you realized that you didn't feel any better? It's a little disappointing, isn't it? You know, somebody cuts you off in traffic and then you yell something really mean back and that should be it, right? But actually, you carried on in your heart. I remember when I was 15, I was in Dallas with a buddy, and he had gotten his driver's license. He was 16, excuse me. And so we were driving, no parents, no supervision. Here we are, no cell phones back then. And we're just out cruising around Dallas, which is not a small thing for a 16 and 15-year-old. And at one point, and we got horribly lost. His mom was so mad at us, I can't even begin to tell you. But we got lost, and so we disappeared for like 3 or 4 hours in one afternoon. She thought we were going to be right back. And we got lost, and so we're pulling onto this freeway. And there's an entrance ramp, and he's a fairly new driver still, and so he was probably a little overeager, a little anxious, and so he quickly merges, and he cuts this guy off. And this guy is in kind of a souped-up sports car, and so I'm kind of naive. I'm the 15-year-old, and so I'm like, well, we'll just wave and say, sorry. Oh, no, this guy, you hear him gun the engine, and my buddy, he knew it was coming. He goes, he literally turned to me and goes, hang on. And this guy comes squealing around, yells something at us, and then without any room, like not enough room, he flies over in front of us, forcing my friend to slam on his brakes to the point that we start skidding. And this guy guns it and takes off. And here's what I can tell you with reasonable confidence, is that as he drove away, he wasn't like, well, that's it. He cut me off, I cut him off, all's fair. We're even. No, as he peeled away in his car, I guarantee he was still cursing us under his breath. That stupid kid, I can't believe he had the gall to cut me off in his Toyota Sienna. See, we don't just want to get even, we want to get ahead, don't we? See, that should have been enough. You cut me off, I cut you off there, we're good. It's an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. In the Old Testament, we actually see this language. It's called the Lex Talionis. It's eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, and it was common throughout the ancient Near East. It wasn't actually just within the Jewish law. It was actually, you find it in other examples as well, and it sounds brutal to us. Like, we don't think in these categories, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, but it actually served a really important function of preserving justice because it was truly even. It was one eye for one eye. It was one tooth for one tooth. And a judge would rule so that you couldn't take vengeance into your own hands. Because let's be honest, if you take my eye, I don't want just one of yours. I want both. And if you knock out one of my teeth on purpose, I don't want to just take one of your teeth. I want to punch you in the face until you don't have any teeth left. See, the way our hearts are wired, the way that they are broken, is that the justice is actually never enough for us. We don't want to be even. We want to get ahead. You take an inch, I want to take a yard. And you become the monster, as Bono sang, so that the monster can't break you. And what that doesn't mean, by the way, is that you shouldn't seek justice. Because forgiveness is not the opposite of justice. In fact, justice and forgiveness go hand in hand. Forgiveness is the opposite of vengeance. See, I hear some people right now, today, and they're skeptical of forgiveness, and I get it. They think we should stop forgiving everybody else because they think that it's damaging to justice because there are people who have abused forgiveness. They've used forgiveness as a way to silence victims and to allow abusers and perpetrators to continue their crime and their sin. And you can see it on the news everywhere right now. You just have to pull up a few headlines, and we see it. I'm so mortified and so embarrassed by the fact that we see this in churches, where leaders in churches have silenced women and families that have come and spoken out against abuse within the church, and leaders have silenced them and said, no, in the name of Jesus, you just have to forgive them. Just forgive and forget. You don't need to bring the courts into this. You don't bring the law. You just forgive and forget. Can I tell you that that is spiritual abuse? It's the wrong thing. It's not what God intends at all. Because you can forgive and you can have them thrown into jail. In fact, I'll just tell you right now that if you know someone who is an abuser, and they are committing these kinds of atrocities against other people, you should forgive them and then you should call the police and have them arrested. Because sometimes the most loving thing that you can do for someone is to forgive them and then prosecute them to the full extent of the law. But here's the reality is that even if you get that justice, if you've not forgiven them, your heart won't be satisfied. Your heart will still want your pound of flesh. Your heart will still long for revenge, and you will still be imprisoned and you won't be free. Do you ever feel like your life decisions are more in response to the actions of others towards you instead of your own free choices. See, when someone hurts you, it creates a chain reaction, if you will. It sets in motion responses that will, over time, continue to perpetuate over and over and over again. And what we like to imagine is that vengeance will stop it, but it doesn't. Vengeance actually just keeps that destructive pattern going forever. And so you can imagine revenge, you can plot revenge, you can actually carry out revenge, you can get justice, but if you don't forgive, then what happens is that reaction, that emotion that was started all that time ago, it will keep you from your future because it will hold you and chain you to your past. Hannah Arendt in the 1950s, she's a German-American philosopher, and she wrote a really fantastic book called The Human Condition. And in it, she talks about how we are so confused about vengeance that we think that vengeance is the way to stop what has happened to us, but actually, she says, it's actually a continuation of the same pattern. And that forgiveness is the only truly free act that will free us and break that chain that holds us to our past. And so this is what she says. I want to just read this to you. If I can, it says this: forgiving is the only reaction does not merely react, but acts anew and unexpectedly, unconditioned by the act which provoked it, and therefore freeing from its consequences both the one who forgives and the one who is forgiven. The freedom contained in Jesus' teaching, and she's not a Christian, by the way, but she looks at Jesus, and in her words, he is the one who discovered forgiveness. And so she always points back to Jesus. The freedom contained in Jesus' teaching of forgiveness is the freedom from vengeance, which encloses both doer and sufferer in the relentless automatism of the action process, which by itself need never come to an end. In other words, forgiveness is like this bolt of lightning. It comes out of nowhere, seemingly. It's the king, as this servant comes before him, and there's no way he could possibly pay this debt, and we know how the story should go. He should be sold into slavery in order to pay his debt, but instead, in that moment, the king breaks the chain, and it's like this bolt of lightning out of thin air that suddenly puts a stop to the offense so that both are free. And see what Arendt is saying here is that instead of continuing the pattern and perpetuating the past, when you forgive, you're breaking from the past. You're breaking from this chain reaction and setting a new course, a new trajectory for your life into an entirely new future. And like the king, you have to show that person compassion, cancel their debt, and let them go. When Carrie and I, we were living in Pennsylvania, we lived pretty close to a state park, which was beautiful. Oh my goodness, it was so beautiful. And there was all kinds of wildlife. We'd get wild turkeys walking through our yard and foxes. We also had mice. That was just the other downside. And Carrie really didn't like the mice. I didn't like the mice, but I tried to deal with mice fairly humanely as much as I could. So I tried to deal with them humanely. But there was, when the winter, it just got cold, and so they would try to find any warm space that they could. And there was one. I like to think it was one. It might have been more than one, but in my mind, it was one. And he found a really nice spot in our heating duct, AC, you know, HVAC duct that went through our living room ceiling. And so all the time, you'd be sitting in the living room, you know, you're like playing a game, or you're watching TV, and you hear this little scuttling of feet across there. And over time, for me, it just became normal. I thought, it's a mouse, you know, I really didn't know how to get to him, and I didn't want to hire somebody to really figure this out. He's one mouse, and after a little while, I actually named him in my mind. I don't think that I ever told Carrie this, but his name was Marvin. And Marvin was just, he was just basically a pet that we never saw, and he just lived with us. He was a permanent resident of our home, and over time, he just became very normal to me that Marvin would be scuttling across the ceiling. I almost missed it when I didn't hear him. It just became part of life, a part of our home. And the reality is, though, there's really never any acceptable reason for having mice living in your home. It's kind of dirty and not really a great thing. See, there are some of you, and you have people living in your mind, and they're taking up space rent-free. And you've lived with them for so long that you don't even notice that they're there anymore. In fact, you would almost feel lonely if they weren't. And maybe it's a parent who has so deeply wounded you because they didn't love you the way that they should have. And maybe it was a friend who stabbed you in the back. Maybe it was a spouse or an ex-spouse who cut you so deeply, you might be sitting next to that person right now. And the reason it's so hard to forgive is because in order to forgive, you have to let them go. And when you let them go, it feels like you're letting them get away with it. And the reason it feels that way is because that's exactly what you're doing. You have to let them go. But to do that, you have to, in a sense, let them get away with it. See, the king, when he has compassion and he cancels the debt, then he lets him go. But the only way that you will ever be free is to let them walk away in your own mind. Because the person that's actually imprisoned, it's not them, it's you. And you have to stop having those conversations in your mind over and over and over again. You have to quit replaying those moments and that pain over and over and over again. And you need to tell that person who you know is just imaginary, because the real person, they have no idea this is happening. But that person who is taking up space in your head, you have to say, I don't want you in my brain anymore. I want you to leave. And so I am releasing you. I am letting you go free of charge. I'm not going to hold you to this anymore. I'm going to let you get away with it in a sense. And it doesn't mean that you shouldn't have a conversation with them. You should. There are circumstances where you need to confront that person. Sometimes that is not possible anymore, though. Sometimes justice is not an option for you. Sometimes that reconciliation is no longer possible. And even then, they live on in your head, and you have to release them. You have to let them go. See, this is the king who has compassion. And he cancels the debt, and he lets them go. And here's why this is so painful. This is why this is so hard, is because when you cancel the debt, you have to pay the bill. When you cancel the debt, you're the one who absorbs the loss. Hey, have you ever broken something that belonged to someone else and they paid the bill? I remember one time I was at a buddy's house, and he had a dog, and the dog ate the buttons off my coat. And it was, as I recall, the only coat that I owned, and I really liked that coat, and I lived in Chicago, which means I really needed that coat. And I remember he said, oh man, I'm so sorry, can I pay to have the buttons put back on your coat? And I didn't want him to have to do that, and so I said, no, it's okay. But see, the buttons didn't magically regrow on my coat, I had to pay the bill. I canceled his debt. Yes, he owed that to me, it was his dog, but I said, I don't want you to have to do that, I'll absorb the loss. See, the king, when that servant steals all of his money from him, embezzles it, he loses it, whatever happens, understand that the king, he's not covered by the FDIC, right? There's nobody insuring that amount. He absorbs the loss. He says, I'm going to pay the debt. I'm going to absolve it. I'm going to take it all upon myself. See, forgiving someone means canceling their debt and letting them go. It means making this incredibly bold statement that I care more about you than what you owe me. See, that's the compassion of the king. He took pity on the one who had a debt he could never repay. He canceled his debt and let him go. And see, that's forgiveness. That's forgiveness. I've had friends fail me and turn their back on me. I've had people hurt me and my family in ways that it's taken years to heal. And I tell you that the most powerful tool that I found in letting people go, forgiving that debt, absorbing it myself, is empathy. See, this is the compassion that the king feels. It's being moved in your inner being towards that other person. And so what happens, the empathy that we need is when we see that that other person belongs to the human race, that they are human beings, to see them in their humanity, to realize that they're not that different from us. And to realize that I'm not that different from them, that I have my own failings, that I need to be forgiven as well, to identify with them instead of painting a caricature of them in my mind that I can beat up like a punching bag and continue to hate. Miroslav Volf is a Croatian theologian, and he lived during he's still alive, but he lived through the Croatian Civil War in the 1990s. He saw ethnic cleansing and just incredible atrocities, and he puts it like this: forgiveness flounders when I exclude the enemy from the community of humans and myself from the community of sinners. See, when I recognize their humanity and my own sinfulness, that I've hurt other people too, then the distance between us that feels so immense, it begins to shrink. And you begin to see yourself in them and them in you, the power of empathy, so that you can move towards them in compassion and that you can choose to cancel their debt and to let them go. Because this is what God has done for you. See, we don't like to admit it. We don't like to think about this part of it. But see, you and I, all of us, we are the first servant. And we owed God a debt that we could not possibly begin to repay. And you may not like that idea. You might be here. You're like, I don't owe God anything. God has no say on my life. Can I tell you, I get that. But your heart tells a different story. Because what I know about you is that there is something inside of you that you can't escape that is telling you you are not who you were created to be. That you're not who you should be. And if you're quiet, your own conscience speaks against you. That there are people that you have wounded and that you have hurt. That there are words that you wish you could take back and actions that you wish you could undo. And you look back and you have those regrets for your mistakes and for your failures. And what I want you to know is that God isn't holding those things against you. He looks with compassion upon you. And that Jesus came not to throw you into prison, not to throw you into hell, but he came to pay the debt that you owe, to take your place, to give you the life that only he could give, a life of joy instead of bitterness, a life of love instead of hate, of forgiveness instead of resentment. And when you know how Jesus has forgiven you, then you can forgive. When you see and you experience and you understand and begin to taste the depth of his compassion towards you, you can show compassion. When you see the debt that he has canceled for you, you can cancel the debt of others. When you see how he has freed you from all that's held you down, from the past, the sin, the brokenness, then you can let others go as well. Can I tell you that knowing that Jesus has forgiven you doesn't make forgiveness easy? It makes it possible. And it may still be the hardest thing that you'll ever do in your life, but I'm telling you, it is also the most life-giving, the most freeing choice that you will ever make. See, at the end of the parable, when Jesus says that if you don't forgive, that God's not going to forgive you, he's not saying that God's withholding forgiveness from you unless you forgive. It's not like God's waiting, okay, are you going to forgive? Then maybe I'll consider forgiving you. God has already provided forgiveness through Jesus. The question is, have you received it? Have you accepted it? See, the servant, he took the king's forgiveness, but he took it for granted. He didn't really receive it. It didn't change his heart. See, when you understand the depth of the forgiveness that you've received, if you understand the debt that has been paid on your behalf, when you know that kind of forgiveness, it changes your heart. It changes you. And see, what Jesus is saying is if you know that kind of forgiveness, if you've truly experienced it, if you've truly received the forgiveness that God has for you, then how could you not be willing to forgive others as you've been forgiven? I know that there's so much more that could be said about forgiveness. And we're just scratching the surface, honestly. And we probably should have a whole series on forgiveness. Someday we will. But this is the first step. This is where healing begins. It's when you know that Jesus paid all of your debt. He paid the full penalty for your sins. And that when you give your life to Jesus, he sets you on a new trajectory towards an entirely new future and a new life. The life that you were created for.
Thanks for listening to the Easton Bible Church podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's message and that God will use it to speak powerfully into your life. If you have questions about how you can have a relationship with Jesus or would like more information about our church, you can connect with us on Instagram and Facebook or go to the Easton Bible Church website at ebc.org.